Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Ben Roy Turner.
Hello there.
And Josh Brown.
Hello there.
Chaps, I don't know how much time you've spent ruminating on the fact that the final PS4 exclusive is out, but for everybody else, we thought we would go through and just sort of rank the best PS4 exclusives of the entire generation, because as far as Sony's concerned, their output is done. It's the end of an era. And now we've got quite a lot to pick from. So we've put together our top five, individual top fives. Now we're going to do a handful of picking some specific games to break down after that. So, Mr. Benroy, your top five in descending order from 5 to 1 is Bloodborne, Until Dawn, God of War, Death Stranding, and The Last of Us 2 at number 1. And we're going to get back to Last of Us 2 and Until Dawn in a bit. Josh Brown, your number 5 was Spider-Man, followed by God of War, Death Stranding, Bloodborne, and The Last of Us Part 2. And for you, we're going to get to Death Stranding and Bloodborne. And for me, it was Horizon Zero Dawn, The Last of Us Part 2, Ghost of Tsushima, Death Stranding, and God of War, with my two picks being God of War and Tsushima to focus on later. But I thought out of all of those games, we should talk about Death Stranding, because that's the one that even we've kind of forgotten about a couple of times. And then when it comes back up, it's like, oh my God, this thing happened. This thing was a big old deal.
Totally. I just want to say that although I had Spider-Man at number 5 on my thing,
you changed it again.
It's pretty much a stand-in for everything, because I had a solid top 4, but there have been so many great PlayStation 4 exclusives that I couldn't get a fifth, so Spider-Man's there, but by the end of the year, that could change to Uncharted 4, it could change to Until Dawn, it could change to Ghost of Tsushima, because there are so many great games vying for that spot. But yes, Death Stranding is the one that kind of stands out, because like you said, it's a strange game. We have had this discussion many times over the past few months about what is going to be our favorite PlayStation 4 exclusive, and I feel like we always forget about it, but then as soon as someone mentions it, it's like, that was awesome, that is definitely going to be top 3, at least for me it is, because that game left such an impression. And I think part of the reason I forget it is because I essentially binged it in a week and a half, played almost 60 hours of it within a ridiculous time period, considering that, you know, we have jobs and we had other things to do back then. And yet it made such an impression in that time. I just did not want to do anything other than eat, drink, and breathe that game. I remember very vividly having to go to IKEA and getting very annoyed on launch weekend, getting very annoyed that I couldn't play the game, and I came back and hammered it.
Do you remember that launch week, though, where it was just, we weren't doing anything other than talking about Death Stranding, counting down the hours of work till we can go home and play more Death Stranding? There's something about certain games that I think just latch on like that, where it just takes over your entire life. And although I really, really didn't like the ending, and I had a whole thing about like feeling embarrassed that I ever cared in the first place, I still totally champion that game's gameplay and the characters and everything else. Benroy, how did you come down on the whole feeling of Death Stranding?
Death Stranding was more of a moment than a game for me. It sort of consumed me in every way. And I, like Brown, I would get annoyed if I couldn't play that. But getting annoyed by not playing that was me going to the toilet. I wasn't going to have to go to IKEA. No one was getting in the way of me playing that game. I'm getting someone to deliver food to me because I'm trying to reconnect America. And I did that. And I did it all within 4 human days. I remember being the first one to be accursed of knowledge, waiting for people to like
get. Because you were the first one finished, yeah.
I just remember finishing like 4 in the morning, just like sitting there, like, I'm so happy but sad, and I just want to cry. And unlike, say, like The Last of Us 2, which also consumed us for a amount of time, this was pleasant, but yet mysterious. And saying, I just haven't played anything like it. Not even Metal Gear 5, to be fair. No. Like, I've not played anything as weird or as Kojima-y. That's going to just be how I'm going to refer to it.
He does need his own term, to be fair. Do you think going forward that... do you think he did sort of create a new genre, the whole Strand game thing? Or do you think that was more of like a marketing... But do you think developers will take stuff from Death Stranding going forward?
I think it is this idea of people within your world. I think it's taken... I always forget that game. Was it Fable 3 when you have like the dots going around the world? And you know, people...
You did that, yeah, like to represent multiplayer, yeah.
And not Death Stranding, Dark Souls, where you can leave messages. I like the idea of knowing people are in your world and that sort of like persistent and branching off more that way. But... Stranding games are really a genre if we think about it. I think it's just the quirky multiplayer stuff that you put in it. I don't know about you two.
Well, I thought there was enough there. Like, that idea of like group building something, like you sort of in Death Stranding's case, like you help put a bunch of materials into like a motorway that's coming together, or you know, you help build like a comm station, and you know that someone out there will get some benefit from it. And you are sort of like asynchronously moving forward together. I love the feeling of that, and you can't really replicate it in any other medium, and hardly any other games either. Like Dark Souls gets close to it when you're reading each other's messages and stuff, but you're not climbing a mountain easier because someone's left you a ladder or something like that. That feeling was so good.
I keep forgetting the likes and the whole thing of I got so much pleasure out of building roads for people and building things and knowing people that were going to use my zip lines. I forgot that aspect of the game, and that as well, like that became addictive. Yeah. That and trying to find Sam Lake, the little bugger, eventually I got him in the end, but the whole like system, that was really good as well.
Yeah, that whole weird side of like Sam Lake, Jeff Keighley, was it Jordan Vogt Roberts? They just whole media event that was Death Stranding, the whole album that came out, like Ludens, Bring Me the Horizons, new single and everything. Josh, what would you think of all that stuff?
I remember going to one of the places and activating it for the first time, and Edgar Wright popped up, and I was like, he can't be in this as well.
Baby Driver himself.
All of those little poppers, it was like a... It's a distinctly Hideo Kojima game, but I feel like it's a well-done one. I was so surprised about how engaged with the story I was, and I know that you dropped off, Scott, but I think you would have to kind of agree that in terms of like direction and presentation and the way that he filmed scenes, it was so, I thought it was so inventive, the way camera work kind of evoked that mystery that Ben Roy was talking about and the fear of what the hell is going on in this creative world. I thought the atmosphere was just kind of unparalleled, and like you said, combine that with the really inventive and really satisfying multiplayer component. It's one of the only games that's had this social element that's also managed to make it feel intentionally lonely. Like the first time you go through areas, I think it's a great decision that you can't rely on anyone else's structures. You have to make your own. And then when you connect it, you're suddenly open to this web of other players and the things they've built, and it makes your life easier. And it does feel like you are this kind of person out there single-handedly doing something, but then connecting to a wider community, and you feel that through the players rather than you do through the NPCs. Like, it's just, for people take the piss out of it and call it, you know, like a crappy old walking simulator, or all you're doing is delivering parcels. And I feel like that's such a reductive thing. You can do that to literally any game. You can be like, Doom's just a game about pointing, clicking on demons and jumping away. And I feel like, you know, Death Stranding did this kind of like weird walking sim delivery thing, but it made that engaging in the way that it designed its world, the way that it designed its mechanics. And you were playing left and right on the left and right triggers quite a lot, but it was much more than that. Like, the mechanics were so much more robust and interconnected, and it made it feel satisfying. The act of getting around the game space was interesting, and ultimately, like, that's what I look for in open world games, especially trying to master a space, whether it's, you know, the interconnected levels in Dark Souls or the mansion of Resident Evil 1. That's part of the fun, and I think over this generation especially, that element has kind of been lost in a lot of sandbox games. And Death Stranding just kind of embraced it and was like, nah, you need to figure out a way from point A to B. We're going to make it engaging.
Yeah, man. And like, the reward systems are insane as well. Like, I mean, like, Ben Ryan, I know you got the platinum, but it's like every NPC that you talk to, if you do the missions for them, you get way better gear. Like, it's just, it gives you a good reason to do everything, like every last sort of side quest. We can also pivot across too, because I mentioned my first game was going to be God of War. That for me, yeah, is my number one. A few games this generation I've thought are legitimately perfect. There's not a single pixel, voxel scene I would change whatsoever with God of War. And even in like a meta sense, I love that they made something that sort of maturely addresses what God of War is, like making it so that Kratos has an anger problem and that his sort of rage spikes with this rage meter on screen, but he's also learning to be a better father and he's kind of like remorseful about what he's done and he knows that he's this brutal one-dimensional killer, or he used to be, and he's like growing up and realizing that in a meta sense, like for the developers to do that as well. That's the thing that elevates God of War for me. But I don't know, Benroy, were you a fan of God of War back in the day? I know Josh didn't play many of them.
The older ones, yeah. I sat and played. They were the games I played with a friend, and I don't know why I always think about this, but I always refer God of War to like the experience I had with the Scorpion King game. Just like, I would pick it up, bash a few people about, and then put it down. So yeah. I wasn't going into this one expecting much. And I was totally taken by surprise. And it turns out I love throwing an axe at people and just beating them up.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, the Leviathan axe thing, the physics just on that, considering that like the chains of Olympus were this big deal beforehand, going down the axe route. I remember when I first saw that, like leading up to launch, I wasn't massively bothered about it because I didn't feel like you could do it. I didn't realize they were going to do this whole like complete shift of who Kratos is and what God of War is. I thought it was just going to be more God of War, which I was like totally sick of God of War 3. Josh, I don't know if did you like bounce off the series because it was so ridiculous and over the top back in the 2000s?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I know there was like a lot of appeal for that stuff like back in the day. I just kind of found it a little bit impenetrable. Like, I'm sure it was fun. I've only really played a bit of 2, and I know a lot about 3 from like watching critiques and stuff, but it was never my thing. It's not that I was like wanting really complex characters or anything, but I just felt like it just lacked a hook to it, if that makes sense. Like, mechanically it was very satisfying, but I didn't care for the world, I didn't care for Kratos, didn't care for the characters. Like, in general, Greek mythology isn't necessarily my thing anyway, so when there was a shift to Norse mythology, and we got this kind of new kind of more intimate combat system, that was something that appealed to me as well. I didn't like the pulled back nature to a lot of previous God of War games as action. Like, I thought that kind of made it feel less tactile, even though it was very spectacular. So kind of bringing it in closer, both, you know, literally and metaphorically to the character and analyzing what the series was, that appealed to me. And I think they pulled it off in just such a marvelous way. Like, I had no affection for this world, and yet I left just caring so much about, you know, Kratos and his journey with Atreus and the overall landscape and, you know, tapestry that I wove with the new characters that I brought. But most importantly, it gave me a reverence for the original. Like, when he goes, well, spoilers, when the Blades of Chaos, you know, come into play and older elements from the series come into play or are hinted at. Like, even though I had no real frame of reference for that stuff, I still felt it. And I thought, if it's made me feel some kind of, like I said, reverence for that past iconography and mythology, it must be doing something right. And I'm, even though it's only like number 4 on my list, I think it's just like a 9 out of 10 game. So incredibly solid. Like,
a 9?
Not a fan.
Well, it's also
very few things are a 10 out of 10, Scott Kelford, you know. Very, wrong. Very few.
I was going to say, the weapons, there's also the best case I found in the game where you have to use one weapon for one thing and one for another. Normally, I'm like, ugh. Or normally, like, say, in certain games that I'm playing at the moment where I've got to switch stance to press the same button to just do the same thing to a different person.
Oh, it's a different thing.
I get really... It's just that the point was like, okay, give video games. But the Blades of Chaos and the Leviathan Axe, I like the fire and ice element to it. And I like how they are so different, and you need switching to them feels so like kinetic, and you just need to do it to get through the game. And the fact that they only come in halfway through, and I wasn't getting bored of the axe, and then they throw the blades at me, I'm like, yes, let's go.
My thing with the blades is like, because like I said, like thematically, like that's the part of him that I adore the metaphor of him building his new house on top of the Blades of Chaos, or when he moved in, he put them underneath the house and where he was living with Freya. But when you go back to get those chains, I didn't want to use them because I know what he left behind. So that whole side of it for me, I focused on the Leviathan Axe. I'd only use the chains when I absolutely needed to. But did that just land differently for you both? Because you didn't have the sort of like the whole background of like him being this overblown, like teenage angst-tude guy. Like, I was like, you've moved on from this.
I think it still works. Obviously, you had a deeper connection to that moment, but I think, you know, the reputation of God of War is there. If you're into video games, mm-hmm. if you're into Sony's video games especially, you know the reputation of Kratos. He was like this big deal. He has this reputation, even if you don't play the games, of being this kind of meathead and kind of like almost a tragic figure, I guess, with mm-hmm. his family and stuff. And you do get a sense of what those blades mean within the context of the game, to the point where I was a bit like you, Scott. I kind of... I could tell it was such a weighty moment. I could tell that these things had history. It was part of this person he was trying to leave behind or move on from. So even though I hadn't played the other games, I still found myself favoring the Leviathan Axe, the Leviathan Axe, because of the thematics that were embedded into mm-hmm. how these weapons meant something to this character.
It's the bit bit at the very beginning where his bandages fall off and you realize that he's actually been trying to hide it, that he's scarred by it. So many little things like that.
I was so sold from the point of the first boss battle where you fight the stranger, and it's the most Dragon Ball Z thing I've seen in a long time. And I'm not a big fan of that either. I was just so into it. It just told me, and carrying your little head, mate, on your belt for the whole time, and just having some guy chatting to you when he's hanging off your ass.
I love how he flags incoming attacks as well. He's just sort of like, watch out, like it's coming from behind you. We should pivot into the mighty Last of Us 2. Ben Roy, this was your number one, your first game to talk about. What makes Last of Us 2 a big old deal for you?
It's the sequel to my favorite game of all time, for one. I mean, there's bias there, but also I think it's the pinnacle of what Naughty Dog has been building up to, their whole cinematic presence for all this time. And so far, I think it's the perfect, gameplay-wise, the perfect sort of like combination of everything. I prefer The Last of Us 1 to Last of Us 2 still. But there's just so much about, like, from even the little touches like crawling down and hiding underneath a car. Like, I feel like you've never really been able to just go underneath a car in games and it makes sense. Like, screw it, I just get into the car and you can't see me. And yeah, sure, it's got a lot of the old long grass, but there's so much to this game where I eventually begrudgingly cared about everyone in the end, even though I hated a certain someone. And I feel like
We can definitely talk about that stuff because, like, that's obviously the big pivot. I think pretty much everybody who's going to care about Last of Us 2's story will have played through to this point. If you haven't, spoilers for, like, light spoilers for The Last of Us 2, in as much as they do a pivot halfway through where you switch protagonists and you're suddenly playing this new character called Abby, who is responsible for a big old event. And that's the biggest thing. That's the reason that a lot of people hate it. And I can totally get that. My whole thing was that all of that is meant to be intentional. You're supposed to hate, you're supposed to forgive, or you're supposed to at least see that Abby is human as well. And that's the thing that's weird, because that's what over time has made me kind of sour on it a little bit, in terms of Abby sections, I feel like drag on a little bit more. Yeah. And I remember all of us saying that when we were playing through it, just being like, oh, I want to get back to the main character. I want to get back to Ellie. But the point is that you're supposed to be forced to see someone else's perspective. You wouldn't have that if they didn't force you to.
I feel they should have... Oh, sorry, you first, Brown.
No, sorry, Pedro. Go.
I feel like they should have cut between what was going on more, rather than big chunk here, big chunk here. It just felt like a whole giant slab of something else dropped in front of me. You know, I thought I was near the end. As everyone says, you think you're near at the end of the game, and then there's a whole nother game. Yeah. Now, it's great value for money, but at the same time, it just was such a sort of left turn, like, nope, sorry. And it pulled me out, even though I thoroughly enjoyed a lot of Abby's sequences. A bit puzzled why she doesn't carry a knife like Ellie, but for the whole point...
She's got guns, mate, even when she's not picking them up.
She's got guns. And people hate that as well. But for me, it was a bit of an abrupt stop. And even though I wouldn't say like I've forgiven the game, I feel like I know what the game was going for, but I don't want to harass anyone online for it. And I still think it's a solid like 9 out of 10 for me or something like that. I think it's... For me, what I want out of a video game, story, gameplay, give me stealth wherever I can get it. Give me some zombies wherever I can get them, and I don't care. They're zombies. It ticks all the boxes. I'm just going to say that. It ticks everything for me, and to continue saying that I was so precious to me, I just love it. I love it.
How have you found it over time?
Honestly, man, like a lot of people might not like this, and I am, to be fair, I'm a bit sick of talking about The Last of Us Part 2. I feel like, you know, partly the discourse has kind of soured a little bit, but like outside of that, I've played this game twice now. Like, it's the only game potentially ever that I've finished had a week in between and then thought, I want to play that again. I want to go back to see what experience that again, partly because of what you were saying, because I feel like in the moment, you do get those kind of sections where you're like, oh, come on, I want to go back to Ellie. I want to see where this goes. I just want to consume the story. And that is partly intentional, but also an undeniable fault for some people. A lot of people can't get past that. So the second time round, I got to enjoy the progression of the story a bit more and the characters a bit more, knowing everything and knowing where it was leading up to. And I didn't have those same issues with the second half because I genuinely enjoyed spending time with, you know, Abby and Lev and those other supporting characters. So it made me appreciate the sections that I might have been a bit iffy on, you know, from a pacing standpoint, not necessarily a story. I was always on board with a story standpoint. I mean, you know, how the game is kind of structured and framed. The second time around, any potential worries I might have had were just kind of like completely gone. And it sucks because like the discourse has soured. And I feel like just saying that you like the game opens you up to like a bunch of dislikes and stuff. But
whatever, like, yeah, those people exist for everything. You could change your style of shoe and there would be someone campaigning that you've got it wrong or you've done it wrong.
Speaking
or whatever
of, yes. Ellie has really good shoes in The Last of Us Part
she
two.
Does
those
to be honest
Converse, like they I've got a pair of Converse back there that are exactly the same and man, they get bloody rough after one outing. So if you're in a post-apocalyptic story, I don't know how she's keeping them so pristine.
There's a whole point when Dina scolds her for wearing Converses as well. So it's like, why are you wearing canvas shoes? But I just want to quickly add to Josh's point before I hand it to Scott. The whole point of doing that second run, I gave it about 4 days in between. That first run, me playing it, it almost like broke me in some way emotionally. It's the saddest I felt all year. Regardless, it's been as sad as it is, but I was just so down and I couldn't get out of that. And then I went through again, did the game through again, kind of knew what was coming. I got the platinum. I think getting the platinum might have just fixed me, saved me from the despair. But going through again and understanding what was coming, the game sat a lot better with me in the end, and I didn't just feel so wretched and dirty and white at the end.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
By the end of it, it's emotionally raw because I think the point that they're going for is look how much people can't forgive each other. Look how much there's a complete lack of understanding and look how much we can't just try and have a conversation and figure each other out. And that thing was so innately sad on like a human level and a primal level because of everything that's going on right now and has done for the last few years and whatever, and you know, the wider sort of like socio-political landscape. But by the end of it, I was just completely raw because of that. And then I thought, but I did think the game was saying like, look, it's like holding up this giant flag just for like positivity. And, you know, throughout the game, you come across different things, like it promotes nature and you come across different animals and like the value of community and friendships and things like that. And so like, it is really grimy and they really drag you down to the mud. But I think it's to make an overall positive message. It's just that the game is so unyielding and it's so like grim, and they, you know, they put you through hell. Yeah. And that bit when they switched to Abby is so jarring as well.
I've never wanted to destroy something as much as I have the character of Abby. And even by the end, I, because they had both suffered, I felt like the same. I was willing to. I felt like I was willing to walk away. But the whole time, I was like, I'm killing every last one of them. Like that really? Game, it took me over. Yeah, it just took me over.
That's good. I mean, that's what they wanted you to do. I felt like as soon as the Abbey section starts, I was like, I see what you guys are doing. Oh, the dogs have all got names. I was like, yeah, I see exactly what you're doing. And some my part of it was because you then have to be in Abbey's shoes for 10 hours, just being like, okay, what else have you got? And it's not until they flesh the world out more and you find out about the Seraphites and the WLF. And the way that they work and like sort of breeding hate through military and religion, and it's this much bigger comment on factional sort of disputes and tribalistic mentalities.
Yeah, it's like it's a final point. I will say that going into The Last of Us 2, I didn't want it to be a game about different characters. I didn't want it to be about the factions, the Fireflies, because I just none of that resonated with me in the first game, and I just wanted another Ellie and Joel story. But going into the second game, it made me realize how much interesting stuff is in The Last of Us world. Like, I cared so much about what was going on between the WLF and the Seraphites in a way that I just didn't expect to. And I was there. Right. That made me more kind of fine with it kind of expanding the world a bit, because I was like, okay, maybe I should have trusted you. Maybe I should have invested more in the world of The Last of Us outside of these two characters and their kind of friends and family.
Well, I really love the way that they don't necessarily reframe it, but they sort of like, you know, reiterate what the Fireflies stand for. And like, you know, when Abby says to Lev, like, you're my people, it's not about picking a specific faction, it's trying to do the best for everybody. That was such a great takeaway thing as well.
It's almost like they're fleshing the world out for some sort of series that's going to be coming. Almost like it's gonna be really helpful to someone like HBO.
No, Mr. Craig Mazin. Josh, your second game to highlight was Bloodborne. And I was going to say we're drastically running out of time. We're not running out of that much time. But what were your thoughts on Bloodborne? That's at your number two spot.
Bloody love Bloodborne, Scott. It doesn't get enough recognition, does it? Bloodborne, yeah. These lists comes up. Like, when we talk about the best PS4 games, people are like, oh, Uncharted, Spider-Man, Horizon, God of War. And I'm like, no, Bloodborne is so good. Because even though it is, you know, very much in the same vein as the Dark Souls mold of kind of structure when it comes to the world design and the combat and stuff like that, it's very familiar if you played a Souls game. Like, for me, and it, again, it's like, this is a very personal list for all of us, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not like we're saying, now these are the very best games of all time.
That's what I'm saying.
That's what you're saying, because the world of Bloodborne for me is just, it's richer than Dark Souls for me, because it taps into an element of horror that I didn't expect at all going into it. Mm. And I got so much out of afterwards. Like, I still now, years after the fact, I played it at launch, and then I played it again a few years later, I'm still watching analyses and critiques of the world and what's really going on, because the way it pivots from that kind of gothic Bram Stoker horror into this Lovecraftian cosmic nightmare towards the end of the game, I just thought that was so genius and something that I didn't expect and initially did not want. But it opens so many different possibilities and got me invested in the mythology in the world in a way that I just haven't been for many games across this generation. I feel like the ones that I picked out for this list have had worlds that I've been able to just completely dive into and pick apart in a way that I don't normally do it, alongside really great gameplay. And that, combined with the really great gameplay, like the things they added, like the counterattack gun, the new dash, the hunter weapons, which just look so sick. Even the
transforming
dungeons,
weapons,
the transforming weapons, even the chalice dungeons, which I thought were quite an inventive idea, even if I didn't engage with it that much. Mm-hmm. It clicked, and if I had to choose between that and Dark Souls, like the first Dark Souls, I genuinely couldn't do it. But fortunately, Dark Souls was last gen, so I don't have to do that. Now I could just say Bloodborne, bloody good.
Is he not wrong? I was going to say Benroy, because I think you clicked with Bloodborne as well, whereas I just didn't at all. But it's because I came from Souls.
I was very, it's Dark Souls, hard game. Demons are hard. It's they're hard Big games. You just want to be hard. You fall off the side a lot. And then I played Bloodborne. And it just took me. And it took me to the point where I was doing this thing. Is it this?
The sun stance?
Yeah. the Bloodstaff Beast. The Bloodstaff Beast put me to hell and back and basically taught me how to play that game. And I loved it enough, got the platinum. I'd never played something where I just love a good dodge in the game, you see. If only their sequel, the game afterwards, Sekiro, like a superior, like an inferior game in almost every way, had a decent like dodge and wasn't all about big men with sticks, it would actually be good. But
Benoit's campaign against men with sticks has gone across multiple games.
Ghost of Tsushima's got that. I almost swore that it's got that problem as well.
It's got a huge stick in it, yeah.
But Bloodborne, yeah, really good game. And I can't really say anything else that Josh hasn't, apart from, yeah, Bloodstar Beast.
My thing with, I'm not going to... I think Bloodborne is this like immaculate creation if you didn't come straight from Souls. But like for me, I just came from like Dark Souls 2. And I just remember thinking like, oh, it's just Souls with a dodge. And I just couldn't...
It's just better in every way, though. So it's just better.
It's fascinating that, Scott, because I did something similar. I didn't play Dark Souls 2, but I just played Dark Souls, the first one, for the first time, like 6 months or so before Bloodborne came out. So I went straight from that to that. And I was just like, yes, give me more of this. Give me the thing I've just enjoyed in in an equally exciting world with a new kind of twist on the gameplay.
It's totally my fault because I OD'd on that formula because it was like 2013-ish when there wasn't... 2014, when there wasn't that many titles coming out at the beginning of the year. And I went from the first Dark Souls straight into Lords of Fallen, into Dark Souls 2, into Bloodborne. And I was just like, I have burned myself out. And I still... Bloodborne is an immaculate creation. And I love the Lovecraftian stuff like you mentioned, but the game overall didn't grab me like I know it has with so many other people. To move on to another choice, though, go on.
I was just saying, can we just definitely forever... Bloodborne or Sekiro? Vote now, Josh, because you wasn't on that podcast.
Bloodborne, but Sekiro is great.
Bloodborne is the greatest of all time.
He sides with the stick, man. I'm going to go with Sekiro. It's a tighter game. With newer mechanics, my second choice is Ghost of Tsushima, which I finished it last night. That game... I don't know. I'm fighting to say that's my game of the year, mainly because Ori is like gradually sort of firing up the ranks the more I go back to that game. But Tsushima is just so immaculately developed and so many design choices that favor the player. From like the, you know, you choose your own progression, you choose exactly which missions you want to do, you know what you're going to get, but you always have that forward through line of like what you're supposed to be doing and what you're supposed to be getting to. The story itself, I think, is one of the best open world stories ever. Like that genre is not known for great stories. And the characters as well, there's some straight up Mass Effect 2, everyone coming together, everyone pitching in styles energy, and that stuff I didn't expect at all. And it's when it makes that pivot towards the end of Act 2 where it's like, oh, we're all in this together, and everyone's like championing fighting Kotal Kahn, or Koten Kahn, Kotal Kahn's to do for Mortal Kombat, trying to sort of save the island. I just love it. I absolutely love every single aspect of it. I don't know if you're still the same, Josh, because you're not finished just yet.
I'm not finished it yet, but I must have played it. I've played it for over 30 hours. I probably played 30 hours alone last week. You know, I've fully cleared the first area, fully cleared the second area, and now I'm just starting Act 3, which is why I didn't feel it was totally fair for me to rate it on this thing right now. But like Death Stranding, I have been living and breathing this. I've been playing it every night until the early hours because I'm just so invested in the kind of like gameplay loop and the way it encourages you to explore the world. But like you said, the story is something I just wasn't expecting, and these characters, the side characters especially, doing their missions and kind of like following their threads and getting to know more about them, it has engaged me in a way that I just didn't expect when I first jumped into it. I thought the story, kind of the setup, was a little bit rote. These side characters fit neatly into archetypes, but the further you get into the game, I feel like it does some really interesting things with them that are actually really emotionally affecting. Like I was playing a part on Sunday morning that just set the day up for a fail because it was so well done. It was this touching, quiet scene that you wouldn't get in like in Assassin's Creed, and not to just slag that off, but I feel like they wouldn't have the time for something as slow and plodding as these couple of missions, and I played them, and it had such a great payoff with his character that had essentially just been introduced as well, and I thought, man, like this game has something special. It's making me feel things, and it's just coming together in a mechanical and story-driven way, in a way that I didn't expect. I always thought it was going to be a solid, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10, but it has genuinely been elevated to the point of, you know, I think it's probably my second favorite game of the year at the moment.
That's kind of where it's sitting for me. That's mainly some of my recency bias talking, but having since finished Tsushima, and I initially did the games of the year so far, the video that's up on the channel, before Tsushima came out. So there's that too. But Benroy, where are you sitting on Tsushima? I know you're not as big of a fan as me and Josh are.
It's there are certain fundamental things about the game that I just don't like.
Sticks.
I mean, there are
It's a lot of sticks.
I will say that when did we decide, as sort of like in the industry, that someone with a stick needs, you can only defeat them in one way and you can't just defeat them like a normal guy? But
well, it depends on how many stances you're switching between, mate. There's four of them, isn't there?
That aside, I wish there was a mini map. I'm not going to go into more than that because we could be there forever.
If the world could see the WhatsApp thread that me, Ben Roy, and Josh have, the amount of that Ben Roy is hating that he can't look at a mini map. You're not alone. Other people do wish they could see that stuff too. I love the wind mechanic though.
I do this. So here we do. Say that.
Good for an audio podcast.
Yeah, the people on the audio podcast.
He's gone into the background. He's retrieving something. He now has a controller.
This is me. I'm playing Ghost of Tsushima like this. But when I'm riding, this is me the whole time.
Swiping the touchpad.
I felt like when I wasn't doing
it. You're doing it wrong.
When I wasn't doing it at the beginning, I was going around the hill and going the wrong side. I was like, but to be fair, that was more in the first area. In the second area, there's a lot less, it feels a lot more flat, the landscape. So it's not as like sort of harsh for going the wrong way around. Mm-hmm. There are some things that, like I want to drop down the ledge that I know if I just was to walk off it, I wouldn't die. But Jin just won't go over it, so I have to jump. Then he falls to his knees and goes, ugh, and almost
not
dies.
Not a circle, mate. You can roll out of it.
Yeah, now you can, but not at the very beginning. And
you've got to get used to it.
I think I need to, as satisfying as it is, like mechanically satisfying, clearing, like I've done everything like Josh in the bottom section, and I started to do the middle one, but I think I'm going to stop that now and just try and proceed with the sort of the blue, the silver and the gold quest things.
But yeah, you definitely want like a good mix of all three. Like I did like two or three missions of the character ones, and I did all of the blue ones, which is where you get specific armor upgrades or the specific like the longbow and stuff like that. But the gold ones are the main story campaign missions, which I would say like you want one of them sort of every four or five of the other missions. I know Josh, you cleared everything out, whereas I eventually did. I hit credits last night, and now I'm going back over to go regroup with like Masako or Ishikawa or whoever. To finish out the rest of their storylines, which I know to you seems crazy because you've been ramping everything up in order.
Oh, that was utter madness to me, Scott Tilford. You tell me that you'd only played a couple in the first act. Like,
it's not a couple. I've done three or four.
That's insane.
It's not.
Because honestly, like to me, that's the best content for as good as the main story.
You've not seen what happens, mate.
Well, I know. But so far, you've not seen what happens in the side content.
I've been chasing foxes the whole time.
They're really good foxes.
That can do one after a while. But like for me, furthering those threads with those characters made the main narrative more impactful because I had an investment in them. You do get an investment anyway because you do see them around the main missions. But knowing about their backstory, knowing that I've helped them, they've helped me, it just made that bond a bit tighter in, like you said, the same way it does in Mass Effect. Like you can go through Mass Effect 2 and still have an affection for these side characters, but I feel like you get that extra appreciation and literal extra loyalty by doing their missions and learning more about them. Like there is some stuff in the Masako one, for instance, that is some of my favorite parts of like the whole game. Like some of those missions, I just love where they went and what they revealed about the characters. So it is a bit crazy to me, but as long as you do them eventually, I'm all right with it. I don't mind when you do it.
I think it's just the thing with me with that game is just that it feels like an amalgam of all the best sort of, like, there's a lot of sucker punches, like, veteran design traits all over it. Like, they know how to front, like, there's hardly any loading in it. They tell you what award's going to be at a certain place before you get there. Or, you know, like, when you're walking after an NPC, you sort of dictate the speed that they go at. All these little quality of life improvements that you didn't realize other games were missing. And it's just, it's got this Breath of the Wild sensibility to its open world, but it kind of borrows just enough of Assassin's Creed stealth mechanics. Then you have this really great meaty combat system, and the story is fantastic as well. It's just I think it comes together better than it almost had any right to, and it elevates so much more. There's so much heart to it. So yeah, that would be mine. Ben Roy, your second game to talk about was Until Dawn, which rounds us out on this pod. Until Dawn is lovely.
It's like one of the nicest horror experiences I've had, where just some dumb teens are going to a cabin, and then
is there any other kind?
And then are they all going to die? They're all going to survive, or are some going to die? It's up to you. And just, this is a game that I have taken and played with friends and like partners before, and them just the people that don't play games a lot as well, just watch them get to it straight away and experience it, or watch me play it like a movie and then making the decision and just being, it's a game that I show people and kind of like amaze them by a bit. Like, look at this game. It's basically, it's a movie, and it is unlike the David Cage stuff. And I cared about. Like, there are some characters, like, you just got monked by I can't remember his name now, but just some lad jumping out dressed up as a monk, and it's scary the first time, and then the second time, the third time, you're just thinking about getting monked, and I know I'm gonna get monked in a bit, but it's coming. And then as it goes on and gets a bit more serious and scary, there is the tension. And I don't buy the whole people hate the controller bit, where if you don't,
you got to hold it still.
It's not hold it still, but you've also got to move it a bit as well. Because if you just hold it completely still, if you put it on the side, it then kills you, because they knew that you would just do that. But which I think wasn't done as well in the one afterwards. I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, the Dark Anthology.
Yes, I think that wasn't done as well there. But this is for me the pinnacle of that style of game, and the cinematic presence of just like a fun horror movie. And yeah, just.
Well, like, I mean, how underused is teen horror in video games? Like, you hardly ever see it. Like, there's bits and pieces of it in, like, Dead by Daylight, or my mind goes to, like, I think it's called Obscure on the PS2. But you hardly ever just see, like, a group of teens with a game that indulges in teen horror, that's self-aware with it, and has characters almost, like, Scream-style, being like, oh, I'll be right back, and, like, you follow them or whatever. That's kind of the tone that I felt like Until Dawn had, but you're behind the controls and the decisions every step of the way. So, you know, like, on multiple playthroughs, you can pretty much ensure that everyone survives, I think, bar, like, two people.
You can,
there's gonna be different endings.
There's, like, eight people that are decided whether they can live or die. You can kill all off or save them all. And I did it all because I just loved it.
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone who's casting that is great, like Rami Malek and Hayden Panettiere, and it's a great mid-2000s teen cast as well.
And
it's
the whole
Oscar winner Rami Malek is in that game.
Like, Freddie Mercury himself.
And also the fixed camera angles just gave me a nice, like the old Resident Evil vibe of walking around this big house and not really knowing, and having the creators direct me where they wanted me to look and sort of things. And like,
I missed that, man.
That also helped me get monked as well, so
the monk detector was spiking. If there was one thing to bring back in horror, I would totally campaign for fixed perspectives. I miss them. I think they could be done extremely well. Josh, what are your thoughts on Until Dawn in general though?
Yeah, dude, it's sick. Like you said, it has a total mastery over that teen horror genre. It elevates a lot of the mechanical focuses, I think, that a lot of these interactive storytelling games try. For me, it's just, it makes David Cage's, you know, Quantic Dream games look like just like kids stuff, like kids' first video game, you know what I mean? I just feel like compared to like the storytelling in those titles, it's so much tighter, and it has such a, like I said, a mastery over the characters and the genre and the story it's trying to tell. And it sucks a bit, because I feel like the developers haven't made a game to that level since. No. And I wonder whether Until Dawn was a one-off, because I remember when it came out, I thought, right, this is the future of this subgenre. If everything else isn't an Until Dawn, we've gone down. And I don't think there has been a game like that.
Man of Medan, but again, for me, that didn't work. Like, it's got a neat little co-op vibe to it, but it just...
The production quality is not there for them, for me.
And it's too condensed, and they're promising more. And I say condensed is like, we all like quick games, but it just felt like there wasn't enough time to get used to it or want to care about anything. Whereas Until Dawn, by the end, it's great. And also Until Dawn is a game that you could play in a night. Sit, get some friends down, do whatever you want, like on a spooky night, and just play it all the way through. It's great.
It's like a 40 like devoted single player game. It's one of the best multiplayer games you could ever play. Like, everybody's reacting to there's so many twists and turns in that story. There's like the whole flashback thing, the whole, like, you know, the idea that you're like finding out what's happening in the story from multiple perspectives and different characters. Yeah, there's a ton to that stuff. But yeah, this would be our sort of roundup of all the best PS4 exclusives of the generation. I was gonna say so far, but that's it. They're the best PS4 exclusives of the generation. There's nothing else coming out for the rest of this year. So let us know your favorites down in the comments below, or come find us on social media if you're listening along on any of the audio platforms. And let us know what you think. For now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Ben Roy Turner.
Goodbye.
And Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
I will catch you next time.
See ya. Bye.
Don't get monked.
Never get monked.
Tired
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.